Blog Talk Radio.
Patriot Nation Radio Live, 347-637-3942.
That's right, 347-637-3942, 347-637-3942. Thank you, Doc, for that advice. So welcome to the Patriot Nation Network, the American Allegiance Show. We have a great show tonight. Tonight our guest is attorney Brad Geyer, who has worked on the 1-6, has a client who's actually in that prison. And as you know, I have a friend there in that prison as well. So we're going to hear the latest updates. This is probably going to blow your minds when Brad comes on. But first, I want you guys to visit browniefoxpublishing.com. And we've got some new books out, and we're actually looking for more authors to publish. We are a legitimate publishing company. And sanctioned by the state of Iowa. We'd be happy to read what you have. So we thank you for that. Go buy a book or two and enjoy it by the fire if you live in states like mine. It's very cold all the time in the winter. So without any further ado, we're going to bring on Bradford Geyer and see what's new in his neighborhood. Brad, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good evening, Kevin. How are you?
Great. I can't believe you're going to do my show again after you went all the way to the top with Donna Fiducia Newen. So thanks for coming back. I see you a lot on YouTube as well.
It's an honor and a privilege, and I very much appreciate your devotion to getting the truth out and to your listeners. And as I promised, I'm sure that there's going to be information that they never heard because, frankly, I haven't discussed it with anyone outside a very tight group. As you're well aware, I got involved. I kind of backed into this. I'd been working on the early treatment fight to get folks early treatment in response to contracting COVID-19. And, of course, there was a huge effort to prevent anybody from getting proper medication early on after contracting COVID-19. And so we're very much involved in that effort. And when this – it was around September, I became friendly with Kenneth Harrelson's wife, Angel. We got to know each other. And it came to my attention that her husband was actually in – the Department of Corrections facility in Washington, D.C. He and about 30, at that time, 34 of the 38 prisoners had refused to be vaccinated. And as a result, they were sustaining a number of punishments, including they weren't permitted to practice religion. They weren't permitted to get a haircut. They weren't allowed to get a shave or their nails trimmed. And probably most cruelly, they're treated uniquely in that they were not able to have any kind of physical contact or able to personally observe their loved ones' faces. So where others occasionally were given a pad, an electronic pad that they could maybe see their child or their loved one or a parent. If you're not vaccinated, you're not afforded that. The most you get occasionally and rarely is a phone call. So I came on in early September. I thought he had a good case just looking at it. after about a week, to my total shock and horror, I realized that this man was completely innocent. I'd reviewed the evidence, and I was just shocked that the things that were said in the indictment at that time, it was the fifth indictment at that time, we're now on number seven, that a lot of the lion's share of the language used by the government in framing the means and methods of the alleged conspiracy, framing out the overt acts, et cetera, were just false. And that, I found that alarming as a former Department of Justice prosecutor. I found that alarming because when I was in the federal government prosecuting cases, we made damn sure that our language was accurate. And we avoided certain usages of language. For instance, breach, the word breach. The government made prodigious use of it, that word, and framed the Oath Keepers as having breached the Capitol door. And, of course, at the time, one of the first things I noticed from videotape that was under a protective order, so members of the public can't see it, is that the door was clearly open from the inside. It made no sense to me that the federal government was accusing my client of having breached the door, which is essentially the concept, you know, the concept of breach is like punching a hole in the wall. Like if you're going to invade a castle or something, you're going to breach the wall or breach the gates. And that clearly isn't what happened here. The door was open at this time. This is about maybe early October, because getting any information out of the government is like literally pulling teeth. At this time, I knew that the door had been opened from the inside, and it looked as if it had been opened up by people who, at least as a legal tactical matter, might be characterized as invitees, because some of the people, at least at the time, we hadn't identified these people and tracked how they came into the Capitol. It was at least theoretically possible that they'd been let into the Capitol. Now, flash forward on that issue until about, I guess it was early January. This is just in the wake of, this would have been indictment number seven. Now our clients have been charged with sedition and all these other terrible things that are, again, just as false as the first six indictments. And what we noticed is that the door, well, I'll back up 1 week. On the same day that they had the march regarding vaccine mandates in Washington, D.C., the government was kind enough to give us a tour of the Capitol. And so I went, and, of course, the number one item on the agenda list that I had was to go over to the east of the Capitol and physically inspect the Columbus doors. And I quickly saw that when I was in that area, the people, the minders who were with me on the tour, were not very happy about me being there, and they got visibly agitated. I asked one of the police officers about how a key functioned, and it was like they threw flags and warning bells started going off, and they said, you know, if they instructed me that if I insisted on asking questions, that I'd be asked to leave.
Really?
I found that very strange. It was just, yeah, it's bizarre. Like, it's a year later, and I'm ashamed to say that I don't really understand how the door operates. I don't understand. I have some theories, but getting any kind of confirmation from the U.S. Congress or prosecutors or the agents that are working on the case, it's literally like pulling teeth. And of course, this would potentially be evidence that exculpates the defendants. If somebody from the Capitol helped open the door, or if somebody authorized the door to be open, or if there was a third party area, say a security room, where a door had to be disarmed in order for it to be released. If any of those things were true, or some other things, that would tend to exculpate my client. And I'm saying it's literally like pulling teeth. And this is, you know, these are magic words. This is Brady information. It's like going in and doing, extracting the teeth out of somebody's mouth. That's how hard it is to get this information out of the government. And it makes me sick, and it makes me sad to see it, because I'm a former federal prosecutor, and I viewed it as my sacred obligation to turn over any and all information that the defense could use to exculpate their clients. That's your job, and it's very, very hard to get this information. I still don't have it. I've heard different things about the door. There's been essentially a omnibus no suggesting there's no way for that door to be opened other than with the door depress handle. There's no, you know, security room or another another place where there might be a switch. But here we have this video from the inside, and it looks like I don't see anything from the video that would suggest to me that it could have been opened based on what I'm seeing people do, that it could have been opened just by what they were doing. Very, very hard to get this information out. We're fighting to do so, but again, it's very hard. So this has been an ongoing struggle that we've had. Then it was about, I guess it was the second week, and this is all new because I haven't publicly commented on it. We were provided with a video that was shot by a French film crew. French film crew came in the morning. It was maybe a third of the way from the Senate guard shack to the front of the East Steps. And it did a little bit of filming. I think it was like a couple of reporters and a camera person. They did a little bit of filming in the morning. And then when a column of agents provocateurs come through the Senate guard post, and some people look at the video and they are curious about how there seems to be so little organized resistance by the police that are at that particular location, but I'm not ready to say anything about that. But the bottom line is they're able to get through very easily, and there was they film this. It's essentially like a column of people, say perhaps over 100, that are in this column, and they walk towards the East Steps, and the camera crew follows this. Around the same time, from out in front of the East Steps, there's a group of people that came through the bike racks. And then in the course of about a minute, provocateurs went along the bike rack line and took all the bike racks down. And literally it happened in a minute. So if you were between the gaggle of agents provocateurs that were in front of the East Stairs, and in between that gaggle column that came through the Senate guard post area, in less than a minute, all the bike racks would have been taken down, and you would have just seen hundreds of people that were walking in what some would know was a restricted area, but others wouldn't, because there's many capitals around the country that have open floor plans. And the film crew sort of follows the filling up of the – there's an initial skirmish line of police that forms on the East Steps, goes up maybe, I don't know, 20 steps or so. And the camera crew is sort of embedded – in a group, it would be the group that's like, say, the third. If you're facing the East Steps, the third on your right, which is on the north side, all those individuals are suspected agents provocateurs that have not been identified, for the most part, have not been identified by either sedition hunters or capital insurrectionists. So these faces are like new to everybody. And there's many of them. I would estimate over 100. And they're clearly depicted on this French film crew video. The French film crew is ensconced in this group, filming different things that are of great import to the defense of the Oath Keepers and actually, quite frankly, anybody who's been charged on that day. I mean, really, really important information. They are seen to break through the skirmish line. Again, very, you know, didn't really take much to get through that skirmish line, I must say. And again, in front of the Columbus doors. And they're doing all their different things in the Columbus doors. And what you quickly recognize is like, it's sort of like if you could imagine the Academy Awards and how Meryl Streep, you know, there's all these references to Meryl Streep and you see Meryl Streep in the audience and she's all over the place. Well, there's probably about, depending on how you count, there's many Meryl Streeps that Americans have never heard about or seen. They're very much involved at every demarcation point where the crowd advanced. You know, they took like Audi Murphy level kind of activity to get through the, you know, to get through the barrier. And they play a starring role at each location up to and including in front of the Columbus doors where they're doing all this provocateuring kind of stuff. And you begin to realize when you realize that the door was open from the inside and that it had to be, you either had to go through a sequence in terms of how you depress the door lever or you had to get permission by the Capitol. So like all that activity out in front of the Columbus doors by the alleged agents provocateur, I'm sorry, the alleged MAGA protesters that are really agents provocateur, right? All of that, if somebody looking at it would say, oh, they're trying to break in the door. But those people, they're really sophisticated. They've had tremendous training. The training, it's akin to like some of the training. It's like it's almost like you're watching like an NBA defense and how people, when they go for a pickup game of basketball, they know there's certain rules. That's kind of how these provocateurs, these agents provocateur operate. Like there's certain signals they pick up on and they all kind of organize around. One person will drop an assignment. Another one will pick it up. They have these different techniques to bamboozle, ossify, and distract police officers. They have ways to get police officers to move. They do things with mace. I mean, I could just go on and on and on, and it's not really what I want to do. I want to get it out so that your people, all the people can see it. They can draw their own conclusions. Don't believe what I'm saying. You know, believe what your eyes tell you. But, of course, it's all under seal. And yesterday I was informed by the government that if we file a motion to remove the protective order from this particular video, that the government will, of course, object because it was obtained by an MLAD, Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty, with the French government, and there were certain representations made when it was turned over. So, of course, they have to protect those representations. So the government intends on using this in its prosecution, but it doesn't intend to let it out so that Americans can see what the video shows. And what the video shows, I believe, and what other videos show that I believe, is that there was a mass entrapment exercise that was perpetrated to basically create a spectacle-like situation and then make it very easy for people to get caught up in the moment, momentary lapses of judgment, and you know, here we are, and so little of that's able to get out right now because a lot of the evidence remains under seal. The government's very selective in terms of when and how This comes to public attention, and typically when they file something, they take the most damning, you know, they cherry pick the most damning video they can find.
Of course.
Sometimes, sorry, go ahead.
Sensationalism. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's you know, I really struggle with it because, with all of the, I've never seen information used to bludgeon a class of defendants like we have here. I mean, back in the 90s, there were certain things, you know, certain things, terrible things happened with, say, in New York, I remember there'd be these celebrated cases. And unfortunately, there were, you know, racial undertones. This is 20, 30 years ago, et cetera. I don't, as terrible as that was, it's exponentially worse here. You know, they just beamed out this cherry picked, selected by the prosecution, unrepresentative sample of things that were happening. They remove all the context from it. And they just bludgeoned the American people with this night after night after night. And it shouldn't be that I come in September and I start looking at this information under seal and it's like, wow, there's all this context. You know, the lion's share of the context just never got out. And you have a situation where the system is really operating in unfortunate ways to make it very difficult for that context to come out. You know, they were pretexted, guarded, ushered, and shepherded onto the steps and into the onto the level that the Columbus doors are on. They were there for about 1 minute prior to the door opening. So literally they were at the base of the steps. You know, I was listening to Stuart Rhodes had a detention hearing today. And my God, the government's making such a big deal out of all these texts about, you know, like, oh, you know, regardless of what we do to try to prevent things from happening, you know, it's going to be, you know, bloodshed in the streets in the future. You know, we have to accept it and blah, 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 blah. It's like the government's it's like they skipped English class and never learned what a metaphor is. You know, I mean,
right?
Yes, there are references made in this regard, but they, you know, the Oath Keepers were texting that, riding over in a golf cart. They weren't riding over in a tank. Okay, they came over unarmed. Okay, there were no arms involved. They're engaged in sedition. Or insurrection, don't you think they would have brought arms with them? Of course they didn't, because that's false. It never happened. It wasn't anybody's head. It's in the government's imagination. And they just reached in and just, like, imagine them. I mean, they can do this to anybody. They can come in and they can just take an event and they can just scoop up using a electronic vacuum cleaner and grab all of your communications that you had over, a 1 month period, and spin the most negative interpretations on anything that you say, and then weave it into this crazy yarn that's completely concocted and made up. From the time they got on the bottom of the stairs, they started singing the national anthem. This is, you know, the East Steps is filled with people by this point, and there's people that are on that top floor, the top level at the top of the stairs in front of the Columbus door. From the time that they got to the base of the stairs to the time the door opened, which was 1 minute after they got on that level, it was a total of 3.5 minutes. That's how much time they had to spend the rest of their lives in prison. And,
absolutely,
you know,
yeah.
It was a spectacle Nothing like this had ever happened before. It was overwhelming sound. So it was loud beyond belief. And just, you know, overwhelming activity and flags and, you know, people cheering the Oath Keepers on. Oath Keepers, Oath Keepers. And what will come out is, you know, they were ushered. Everything they did involved them being ushered. And
so you're saying that this whole thing, just like from the beginning, you were talking about the innocent people, the protesters were ushered or herded into the Capitol. And you're saying on the other end, it could only open from the inside. And I understand.
Yes. Yeah, so, yes. You know, this is going to be probably the biggest challenge that the legal system's ever really seen. And unfortunately, because, you know, we need volunteer eyeballs pouring over this stuff. We need your listeners. Become Sherlock Holmes. Find where the video is. Review the video. Help us interpret it. You know, there were, estimates are somewhere between 600,000 to 1.2 million people there that day. And this, the operation that we've seen, and, you know, we're seeing a corner of it right now, right? Like it's probably much more involved and vaster than even we're seeing now. We've been focused on this pretty intensely now for 3 months. Like 18 hours a day. I do 18 hours a day on this. But I'm even only seeing a fragment of it. On January 5th, the night before, you have Ray Epps giving an interview with a live streamer, an alleged, you know, white supremacist live streamer named Baked Alaska. Baked Alaska started out as a BuzzFeed reporter. He then worked for Milo. Milo's career imploded, and then I believe he sort of comes on the stage as this, you know, I mean, if he's not a deep state operative, he certainly looks like one.
okay.
He gets maced at Charlottesville. Anyway, he's on January 5th, the night before, he's live streaming Ray Epps. Ray Epps, former Marine, he's saying, you know, tomorrow we have to go inside the Capitol, not just to the Capitol, but inside the Capitol. And if you look at John Sullivan's videotape, who goes by the pseudonym Jaden X, he filmed Ashley Babbitt, you know, what amazing timing. The murder of Ashley Babbitt, by the way, that was not a legal use of law enforcement. I mean, that's a whole nother story, but I'm not going to engage in the canard that the officer who shot her was working within his rights, and that was a good exercise of law enforcement. She was shot in the neck in cold blood. Let's just get that out there.
Right.
But anyway, John Sullivan, Jaden X, who got that on tape, was also there, and he was able to film Ray Epps being interviewed by Baked Alaska. Baked Alaska did go into the Capitol the next day. He was charged, but he was released on pretrial release, and he reoffended on something. I don't really know what the details are, but he had a couple more interactions with law enforcement. Since that time, I believe, and I believe he's still out and at large, which is, again, unusual, I believe, since my clients are in solitary confinement, basically. You know, it's really unfair, but Epps was around proselytizing people on the 5th. On the 6th, you can see him over at the Ellipse, and he's going and yelling out to everybody that they should go to the Capitol as soon as the president's done speaking. There's strong evidence that he's conferring with others who are like-minded and have the same plan. They're in close proximity. He's in close proximity to somebody named Megan Paradise, who until recently was on the FBI's most wanted list, I think number 6 of the insurrection. And I've heard that she's no longer a subject of an investigation, even though she's extensively involved.
Whoa. No
way. So she's over. She's over with her bullhorn at the Ellipse, telling everybody they have to go to the Capitol using the same language that Epps is. Then she's in the front of the Capitol, saying, "Come on, guys, you have to come with us to the steps. Come on, guys. They're breaking through over in the West." So there's clearly coordination. And then she goes to the steps. This is all with a bullhorn. And she's on the steps, and then she's in front of the Columbus door, and, you know, she's doing these chants, you know, "We got you, now you got us," or something like that. And also, "Take the shield, take the shield, take the shield." And also, through the bullhorn, "Break the door, break the door, break the door." And she also trailed the Oath Keepers in. So she's one of the people that shepherded them in. She was right behind them. You know, somehow she's escaped charges. Makes absolutely no sense. Her culpability, just based on the videotape, is much more extensive. You know, even if you assume the things about the objective things that you see about the Oath Keepers, just look at the video of what the Oath Keepers did. Just look at the video, and you compare the video.
Yeah.
You know, it's on video. I forget his name, Wolf. I forget his last name. There was a famous sportscaster in New York. He'd say, "Let's go to the videotape." You know, and that's what I want to do.
Right.
Let's go to the videotape and let's compare Megan Paradise and the Oath Keepers. It's all on tape. And what I'm telling you is if the Oath Keepers are a 1, Megan Paradise is an 8. Right. And yet she has a clean bill of health, and all those faces that are plainly evident of agents provocateur that adorn that whole, from the Senate all the way over to the front of the East Steps, a lot of these faces are in high-definition scans from multiple angles. And I see all kinds, like, for some reason, they never hit the Sedition Hunters websites. They never hit the Capitol Insurrectionist websites. They never hit the FBI list of wanted. And these are people, it's like, one guy has a rainbow. He's got a rainbow. He's walking around in a rainbow flag. There's only one guy there that I've seen that wears a rainbow flag. He's everywhere, this guy. And he's got a bullhorn. He's parading around everywhere. He's on everybody's videotapes, on the government videotapes, on surveillance tape. No one's ever seen this guy's face. And he's just one of about, I think we're tracking about 120 now. Whole thing is preposterous.
Yeah.
So Megan Paradise is over on the Ellipse. There's others. The first breach occurred, we call it the Ray Epps breach, was at the Northwest Side. Again, if you look at that breach point, there's tactical teams that were involved in that. So, I mean, like, you can imagine – it isn't your typical MAGA protester who's going to just, like, break down bike racks and barricades get into a pushing match with police officers. It just isn't going to happen. You need professionals to do that. So what I think they did is they took efforts to make sure that pint glass was full with activity and emotions and people. They took down barricades. They took down signage. They had people working on bullhorns to move people, to move the crowds up and get them compressed. Because when you get people moved up and compressed around choke points and in enclosed areas, what happens is emotions increase, energy levels increase. And then if you bring in some provocateurs, you take a shot glass, if you take a shot and you pour it in a pint glass that's filled to the rim, that when you pour that shot in, it's going to overflow. And so what they did is they basically made damn sure that that pint glass was filled to the rim, and then they had some provocateurs to pour that the shot glass in to make it overflow. And they did that at each key breach point. And I call it a breach point. I'm actually probably giving too much credit in some instances to the police, because some of these, it just didn't really take much at all to get through. It did take some doing. The West, it gets a little bit more complicated, because the West was just that. The West and the East are very, very different when you're trying to piece together what exactly happened. They're very different. One of the reasons is that the West is a shorter walk, so more people made it to the West. The East was a little bit longer, and so there weren't as many innocent dupes that were in the East. So it's a little bit easier to see what they were up to in the East. So this is what we're trying to unravel. And of course, the government's fighting us at every single step of the way. It would love it for all the bad stuff for their case to stay under seal and, just cherry pick the stuff that, tends to benefit their case. That's the stuff we end up seeing, to the point where, as a nation, we're really prejudiced, really, against this class of defendant. And the vast majority of them are innocent. They really just, when you look at what they did, they just didn't do that much. Some
right,
did nothing.
Right. Yeah. Let me share something with you real quick. Megan Paradise, there's a YouTube video, I don't know if you've seen it, about her. Was Megan Paradise working for the FBI, believe it or not. So, and she's also on extremist.news. They're talking about her on January 6th, and she's sitting at a desk. So what this looks like to me is this has all been a setup, and the reason why they'll never let the prisoners out in their minds is this. There are people behind it that can't be, found out, if you know what I mean. This is too big. The goal was to get the president on the way out and impeach him. So I think this is the whole plan from the beginning. And that's just my opinion. And they use these pawns for fodder. And I hope you get them. You need to get them. I hope this happens. The only way it's going to work. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I have to be selective as to who I deem to be the enemy, right? It's a target-rich environment right now. And, the way I see it is – and by the way, your interpretation is very reasonable. And, based on the evidence, it's a reasonable interpretation. For me to do what I'm doing – I don't even get that far. I mean, I don't know who did it.
Right.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know who's paying for these provocateurs. I don't know who's giving them all the training. I don't know who's coordinating them. I don't know who drafted the plan. I don't know any of those things. I'd like to think that it's not our government. If I were on the other side and I was doing some kind of a caper like this, I think I would plan it in such a way that nobody would ever be able to tie it back to the government. If I was predisposed to thinking I would never do this because it's just wrong, it's not what we're about. But if I was, I think I'd have the wherewithal to plan it so that no one would be able to reverse engineer these people back to the government. So it's most typically going to be either with or without government agency or knowledge. It's going to be some kind of unaffiliated third-party organization. Could be a civic organization, could be a political organization, could be an NGO, a nonprofit, a company, a shell company, could be a lot of different things. As to then I go back a step further. You know, was it the Republicans or the Democrats? I have no idea. I'm hoping it's not. I'm hoping it's neither of those parties. I hope this is not I hope that this doesn't have political motives. I'm actively looking for some other rationale or justification, because wouldn't that be a terrible world if people are using criminal prosecution and weaponizing government enforcement agencies to pursue political agendas? Because once our systems go that way, it's going to be very, very hard to pull that back. You know, that really, actually, I have to be honest, that terrifies me. The idea that could be true terrifies me. So let's go back to the governmental agencies. You know, government agencies are made up of people. And most of those people in those government agencies are good people. Most of them are law-abiding. They're very they adhere to notions of limited government, and they don't abuse their power. Evidently, looks like there's some that may have done that. And so I'm hoping, by giving a vigorous defense for people who I believe are innocent, I'm hoping that by that pushing back, that those good people in these agencies are going to say, gee, you know, things really went a little bit too far. We have to engage in some reform efforts here internally in these agencies and do some house cleaning. You know what, that guy over there, I'm not really sure what he was doing, but you know, this other fellow in the agency, he's in my agency, but he's probably up to no good. It's probably a good thing to maybe suggest to him that it's time for him to retire, you know? And so that's really what I'm hoping for. Maybe I'm being too Pollyannish, because when I see the scope of the effort, when I see tactical teams that are all arrayed at the front of a breach point with Ray Epps, and how they all go in a coordinated way and it's timed, and how they remove bike racks and put them over walls, retaining walls, so that they can't be seen, so people coming in after them aren't even aware that that was a point of demarcation between where you're lawfully entitled to be and what the government says is restricted space.
Right.
When I see that level of complexity, these kind of things just don't. You could have one or two or three working in a concerted way that way. And it might not be orchestrated or part of a larger plan or involve extensive training to include rehearsals, dry runs, et cetera. But when you're talking about coordinating dozens and dozens of people, you have to have extensive training. You have to have prior operations. You have to have funding. You have to have logistics and support. You have to have multiple means of communication that are redundant, so you can't just rely on phones. You also need visible cues, sound, radio, etc. To coordinate in multiple theaters, you know, the West is a completely different environment than the East around that capital. I mean, it almost looks at you like when you're looking at the East and seeing how that thing's unfolding, and then compare it to the West, they're completely different animals. The different entry points, not only the breach points, but at security at the Capitol, how they were breached. Some seem like they were let in. Some seem like they had help. Some broke through. The ones who broke through, you know, there's highly correlational to, you know, having indicia of being what I would call agents provocateur. In other words, you know, there's an occasional person who strikes you as okay, I can buy that person's a MAGA protester, and he kind of blundered in and just acted poorly, and maybe even engaged in crimes. But the more common story is you see coordination, you see timing, you see movement. You know, there's a whole class of people engaged in this effort whose only role was to remove barriers and make sure that people moved up and moved up into empty areas of space in restricted area, so that, you know, there's certain benefits that accrue in those breach points when it's stacked with people and there's too many people there. Provocateurs can have more of an effect. You know, when provocateurs attack the police, oftentimes the police respond, and they respond against innocents, and that gets everybody upset, right? If you look at that tunnel, the tunnel situation is a very complex situation. It's going to require a lot of expert analysis and probably expert testimony. But I know that we have in the East and in the West, on different timetables, we had two separate incidents where one of these, by the way, I've observed myself. Another one, it's based on analysis, videotape analysis. I trust the person, but I haven't seen it with my own eyes. I want to say that. So what I'm going to say about the West, I haven't physically reviewed it myself, but I believe it to be true. In the midst of agitation between the crowd and police, there seems to have been an effort. This happened in the East, this happened in the West, where police and a spokesman, typically with a bullhorn, get into a discussion about seeking permission from police supervisors and letting everybody go into the Capitol. This happened twice. Now, the reason that's important is because when a crowd hears that, any efforts that anybody was engaging in to disperse the crowd are completely sabotaged, because everybody in that crowd goes, oh, wow, if they're going to get permission to have us come in, I guess it is okay for me to stand here. And not only that, if I leave, I may not be one of the ones that are allowed to go in, right? That's number one.
Right.
Number two,
yeah,
if people go through that breach point and they have that in their heads and they see people, many people, beyond a barrier, what the human brain does is it says, gee, they must have got permission. That's what explains
right.
those hundreds of people in an area where I thought they weren't allowed to be in. So it causes confusion. In my view, this undermines criminal intent on a systemic basis. So ultimately, I'd like to see the government just dismiss all these cases against everybody as penance for having created a circumstance where, you know, by the way, I'm happy to blame everybody.
Right.
You know, nobody should remain blameless. I'll blame myself too. But let's just get everybody out from these criminal cases. It's just it's ridiculous. You know, let's learn from it and move on. But when those police, whether those were like earnest discussions and the police representatives were actually seeking permission, or whether, I don't know. I mean, I assume they're real policemen, but let's just, you know, that's an assumption I have. You know, maybe they had some other ulterior motives. And in both instances, I think in the West, it had really bad, effect, because the crowd for about 15 minutes, it got really calm. You know, this is after the police had shot rubber bullets into the crowd. And, you know, it's not like they're doing surgery with a scalpel when you're talking about sending in CS gas shells, you know, that have trajectories and they travel at high feet per second. And, you know, you get hit by it, it causes a lot of damage. And this upset a lot of people. But there's that 15 minute in the west, there's that 15 around the tunnel, there's that 15 minute gap of essentially peace. But then these berserkers came in, you know, who are the berserkers? You know, I'd love to know, because I'd like to see those guys prosecuted. And then they got the
right.
police agitated. The police overreacted. They got the members of the public agitated. They felt like they were acting in self-defense, third-party self-defense. And then what really, where things went really cattywampus, was when the Metro Police Department came out in a pincer movement out of the tunnel. People had nowhere to go. And so they caused this stampede, and people got trampled to where there was like a pile of bodies. And to get somebody out, you know, they'd like have to – they'd lose their pants. That's how much compression there was.
No way.
And that's, of course, where – yeah, it was bad. Like you see in the videos, and this, again, this is under seal, the high-def videos, you'll see shoes, you know, people, you know, like boots. Like the feet came out of boots that were laced up. You know, that's how much compression there was. And Roseanne Boyland, after initially being beaten by the nightstick, then was stomped. And, of course, that's how, you know, they say she died of a drug overdose. Again, I hate to say this. I grew up having a lot of admiration and respect for spokespeople of these agencies. And when I was in the federal government, if an agency made a statement, I basically believed it. There were a couple times when I was like, raised my eyebrows, like that's a bit of a stretch, but by and large, I felt like I could take those statements to the bank. In regards to the pathologist report regarding Boyland, I have serious questions about that. I'd like to know, there's some injuries and a death of a police officer I'd like to know more about. There's aspects to these events that just don't make any sense to me. I've seen on tape injured police officers, and the way it seems like they're injured and who gives aid to those, in this one particular instance, it's about three protesters who give aid to the officer, and there's no other police officers that come to his aid. And I just think that's very odd. I've never seen that before. You know, usually when a police officer is down,
they stick together. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And there's something, you know, and I don't know if we'll ever be able to get to the bottom of this, because the discovery in terms of the police discovery is just, I mean, it's bad. You know, it's bad. I mean, I don't know what's going on in that police department. We're going to have to figure that out. But, there's a lot about the police response that doesn't make any sense to me. And I'm not sure what, I'm not saying they're in on it. I'm not saying they're acting unprofessionally. I'm saying that there's a lot of aspects about the police response that are, have me interested. I want to know more. I mean, I'll say this. I see a lot of private moments and moments where the police are interacting with the public, and I'm really impressed by how they maintain their composure and how just like cool they are. I mean, like they have a really nice way with these protesters, and I'm, you know, it's actually nice to see that, and it makes me, you know, hold them in the highest regard. And so I'm wondering if there's something that's unusual about the rules of engagement, some orders that they were given that manifested themselves as just kind of making it look illogical how the police were responding. So we'll have to learn more about that, though.
I would agree with that.
Maybe.
Totally, you know, they're given instructions or something, possibly.
Yeah, like, for instance, along the east, the way that they're staffed just doesn't make sense. Again, maybe we talk to somebody and he explains, and there's a lot about how police respond that I don't understand. I'm not an expert. That when they explain it to us, it'll make more sense. But yeah, you know what? The next time we talk, Kevin, I hope to be able to have a number of hours in on just focusing on the police. Right now, I'm focusing on the provocateurs.
Right. Well, that's fine.
There's strange how they're staffed in the morning, and how they just happen to be clustered around the group of people that we've identified as provocateurs in front of the east steps. I think that's, you know, needs more inquiry. There's some interesting stuff on the steps that don't make sense. The police responses don't make sense. At one point, a police officer's down in amongst the protesters, and they're all just kind of looking at the police officer without any look of alarm or anything. Ordinarily, you would take your baton, work your way down to the officer, pull him or her back behind the line. Don't see that. That's strange. And then in front of that east door, it's almost like they left a gap between where they were standing in the wall so that protesters could get behind them. And that doesn't make any sense to me. Like, I would think that they would be, you know, they would not want to have a channel between them and the wall where protesters could get behind them. That doesn't make sense to me. But again,
I
don't know. These, you know.
Are they verified to be actual police officers?
I have no reason to suspect that there are
You don't have to answer that. I was just thinking.
Yeah, it's the possibility has crossed my mind, but I have no objective evidence to suggest that there's anyone who's not either from Capitol Police or from MPD. They were the district's police that came over. There's also some tactical units from FBI, ATF, I believe, and a couple of other agencies. I have a report that I believe to be accurate and reliable that there were some ununiformed, non-uniformed special forces operatives in the crowd. And again, from my vantage point, you know, those we could put those in the actually all these guys, we could put them all in the good guys camp. I mean, I think that where you see I think my hypothesis that I'm working on, because look, I'm like everybody else. I'm a big supporter of law enforcement, right? So where I see law enforcement
right.
not acting properly, it's generally a failure in training. It's a failure of, you know, not having enough staffing, or it's a failure of orders. And we may have had a combination of all three here. You know, like I said, these guys that woke up that day weren't expecting this to happen. But if their management purposefully understaffed them to increase the probabilities that there'd be overreactions, there'd be improper responses, or just so that to ensure there'd be an ineffective response, that's the wrongdoing that I would want to ferret out and put on public display.
Absolutely, yes, definitely. This is an incredible, you're taking me through this incredible journey here, this story, and things that I never thought of. Or I have friends that were there, but, you know, they can't see everything. They can't review what you saw. So this is really fascinating. And the thing is, if they're not on charges, how can the prisoners be kept? How was that even possible?
Yeah, I mean, I know that my client is totally innocent. I don't just mean in the eyes of the law because he hasn't, you know, been given a trial and convicted. I mean, I'm looking at the evidence, and I honestly, earnestly, as, you know, sure as I'm sitting here, I honestly believe he is totally innocent. I don't think he did anything wrong. Kenneth Harrelson, retired sergeant, disabled veteran, a great, great American, you know, came, you know, lives in the hurricane zone down in Florida, married his sweetheart from an even worse hurricane zone in Louisiana, who grew up in a trailer because their houses kept getting wiped out. So these, right. these people just okay. routinely would get hit by hurricanes where they have to, you know, they have to worry about, you know, setting, you know, the police are down for the count. So you have to basically organize the local populations to put in auxiliary, you know, police force and security force and make sure, you know, people can do medevacs, make sure ambulances can get in because there's trees down. I mean, this is the kind of life this guy, he was a welder and like an amazingly gifted welder. Elon Musk is his idol and his hero. He worked for Elon, you know, in one of Elon Musk's companies, making sure that all the welds were done perfectly on the rockets. You know, trying to explain to somebody in Washington, D.C., how there's this, you know, you want to call it a gun culture or whatever, how people go to the range and they train and, you know, like these Washington people, they just don't understand because it's foreign to them. It's like you're telling them, talking about, you know, like life on planet Mars. And this is just like, you know, how things are in Louisiana and Florida. And it really is. You know, I'm worried about legitimacy. I mean, I'm worried about institutional legitimacy. That's really my primary concern. And after we get Ken Harrelson out and he's exonerated and we get him his job back, because I know Elon Musk is a fair guy and will welcome this great worker in with open arms because he's totally innocent. I'm worried about institutional legitimacy. Because that this could have gotten this far in the nation's first mass political prosecutions. I mean, I think we're going on 700 now, I believe, and they're projecting they're going to go over 1,000, where you could have this preposterous use of language in federal Department of Justice indictments, use of the word breach, preoccupation with what the oath keepers were wearing, what kind of clothing they wore, preoccupation with metaphors they use in communication software, the focus on using communication software that is encrypted, like WhatsApp is encrypted, Messenger is encrypted, Signal is encrypted. So is it that we're all criminals because we text? You understand? And I could go through the whole thing. They made a reference in indictments 1 through 5, and 1 through 6, actually, that he had paramilitary training down in Florida. It shouldn't be that I come and I do an internal investigation just on that, and I stumble on a state statute in Florida that makes it a crime to teach paramilitary gun training. So, of course, I call the person who's an NRA instructor. And I say, because it says it in the indictment that they received paramilitary training. Again, me being from the old world, where when the U.S. government and the Department of Justice says something in an indictment, you assume it's true. Like, I can't tell you the significance of this. It's hard for me to even impress upon somebody. I mean, like, we used to have battles over the use of language internally to make damn sure that it reflected the actual truth of what happened. And we would always tone down our language, make it more boring, right? What I'm seeing is the exact opposite. It's like I've come into another. It's like a Department of Justice that I don't even. I don't even know what's going on. I see the language use. It's just it's the surplusage, the overheated rhetoric that just adorn. You know, they make references to communications in the indictment, which are exculpatory. Like, and it sat in the indictment for six indictments. It was in there. And the language they were citing, the alleged incriminating chats, were exculpatory. And it's like nobody noticed. Like, this is not how it used to be done. This institution had – you had people that were in it for, you know, 30, 35, 40 years. And they made damn sure that that there was only the best quality control was coming out of this institution. And I got to say, the investigations, I hope someday this comes out, but I mean, like, man, I got to say, man, it's not the FBI I remember. That's all I'm going to say. I mean, oh my gosh. I mean, there's, I hope to have more on that next time we can talk, but
right.
Suffice to say that these charges, the way they're framed, the way the cases are being brought, you know, when they do these arrests and they bring in 20 agents with some like armored vehicle with a battering ram,
yeah,
to take down some
right.
school teacher.
I remember those.
I mean, it's just,
right.
And it's scaring people. Like, if that was their intention, to scare Americans, they've succeeded. Because, like, Americans are looking at this, they're saying, wait a minute, this isn't what I remember. Like, this, you know, all I can hope and pray for is that as we get the truth out and as we unwind some of these cases and continue to protect the neutral ground for our opponents to retreat to with dignity, because that's important, I'm hoping that people inside these agencies take a really cold, calculated look at how these agency operations have been conducted, and they start to pull back and start getting back within the parameters of rule of law, limited government, and just tone it back. This is not helping out anything. Going down and pulling people out of their homes down in Louisiana, Texas, and Tennessee,
Ohio,
Kansas, Ohio. It's not doing anything to reduce concerns. It's not doing anything to you know, mitigate overheated passions. It's having
right.
the opposite effect. And it's like, we all have this country together. And I sat there for a year while, again, everybody has their own opinion, but I believe that a lot of the conduct that was happening in these cities with the rioting and the looting, that was objectively worse, you know, in the wake of the inauguration,
definitely.
Vast
yeah.
tracts of D.C. were on fire for a while there. Right. And I think those people, most of those people,
senators,
the cases
yeah.
were dismissed against them. So
right.
I don't think a lot of them were prosecuted. So let's get back to an apolitical justice department that just goes right down the strike zone every time. When something comes out in a pleading, take it to the bank. It's going to be accurate. It's going to include – it's going to be clear from how that document is pled that it's a true expression of the full context of what's happening, what's going on. Let's get those management chains back on track, doing their job.
I agree. And I was a federal employee just like you, and things were never like this. I was in 30 years. I got a question for you.
Oh, my gosh. There'd be a lot of planes crashing, Kevin. You know what I mean?
Right.
This, seriously,
yeah.
If this rot went over to your prior AORs,
right?
If this kind of thing had gone over there, there'd be planes literally falling out of the sky right now.
Or they wouldn't get off the ground. Okay, I know, my friend, here's a little thing, update for you about Therese Borgerding, okay?
Yes.
She's one of the persons
yes.
there. She actually had,
yes.
she had cancer. Her husband has completely disappeared from the face of the earth. There's no communication from him, nothing. I'm suspecting that he's there too, but I don't know. His name is Richard.
Can you send me offline? Can you send me an email with all the identifiers,
sure.
and I'll see if I can't track down your friend and see,
okay.
Assess what's happening and where they are and stuff like that.
Okay, yeah, I'll do that because you know this. I know she is like the kindest person that you could meet, and she just got over cancer. She's a veteran wife. She supports the troops, everything, you know, and this is incredible. I can't even imagine what she's going through right now. And these are not criminals that they've arrested. These are Americans who wanted to be there for their country. And whether they got sucked into the building or not, there's no crime they did. They didn't know. Nobody knew anything. This is what drives me crazy because they're just so rogue. And I think you hit the nail on the head. I think the problem is Washington, D.C., not the FBI, not the police. It's the seat of power. I think there's something bigger behind it that we don't know about. Just my little
yeah.
It's a probability.
It'd be great to, like, look, we're all going to be better off in the career civil servants in these agencies are going to be better off, I believe, if we go through a period of reform and restoration and get everything back on track. Most of the agencies that I see are functioning at a degraded level of performance compared to, say, a decade ago, or where they've improved in performance is where, you know, it's not an improvement. You know,
right.
How it is that we could have these, you know, hundreds of agents and prosecutors chasing parading grandmas when we have so many other problems.
Exactly.
You know, it's really, you know, because I see this as a mass entrapment effort, the system, by the systems. I'm not saying this, when I say entrapment, people think, I mean, it might involve components of government, but I'm not alleging that.
Right.
I'm saying this, the way the systems have evolved, C-19 and this January 6th event are both essentially mass. They devolved into a mass entrapment exercise where the government ends up dehumanizing its population. And in the case of January 6th, really, in terms of the Oath Keepers, really treating the Oath Keepers like something akin to prey. I mean, these the ushering and just kind of getting them on a track from the bottom of the stairs into the Capitol, it's concerning. I mean, this you know, how could these systems have developed to make it that seamless? How is it that these, I mean, where do these agents provocateur come from?
It was a sting operation.
I mean, were they around 10 years ago? And these numbers were, you know, they're like basically professional protesters and professional rabble rousers and looters. And like, how was this market created? How is this population of people, you know, who's behind it? I'm not saying it's the government. I frankly don't know, but I think we need to know.
Highly organized, I believe. It may not be the government, but, you know, I think they use them in other places, maybe the summer of 2020, carrying and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So many things. I mean, they seem to be, like you said, so organized. And people that were there will even say, hey, these are not us. And this is the first time a Trump rally turned into something like this, which is like, it doesn't happen, like you said earlier. things like this don't happen. You don't have criminal elements in the ranks. That's the thing, and that's why this makes no sense. I don't know if it was Black Lives Matter or something else. We would believe it. Sure. Yeah, okay, they deserve that. But we know that's not how it works. That's not how the Trump fans are and the supporters. Those people were there as a request, you know, from the president. And guess what? The big target was the president. So this is why I say, this is why they're stonewalling, and people who are prosecuting have no conscience. This is more alarming to me than anything else. They don't care. Or this is their mission. That's all I have to say about it. This is so amazing to me how this is still a problem. This is still there after all this time. And they delayed in picking up people. Like my friend Therese, they waited till July to get her. This makes no sense.
Mm.
Because I know, like you wrote in there, they use that algorithm or whatever, that program, to find her because she's friends with somebody on Facebook. And as you're going back, you're talking about the government. When I was reading on your page, the government continues to bury defendants in tsunamis of worthless information. So
yeah.
So they're not even playing the game. They're in low gear right now on this whole thing, it sounds like.
Well, what I'll say is that the problem is that when systems devolve to this state, to get to a good result when you're in the system, I mean, I don't want to be too hard. You know, I want to be respectful to people
right.
on the other side of the table from me.
Yeah.
I mean, probably the reason that they don't just go in and fix the whole problem overnight is the same reason that I don't, because it's just too damn hard, and it's probably not possible. There's just too much a raid around these the current state of affairs that no one person or no small group of people can go and like a surgeon go in and extract a tumor. We're all kind of stuck with this, and they got it. You know, they were dealt a hand too. They had this very, you know, incriminating set of evidence that comes on their desk. Their job is to turn it into a case. And,
right.
You know, the fact that it's missing all this context or that, you know, it's overcharged or all these other things, I'm certain it's within ethical limitation. Like, I don't believe they're acting in bad faith. I just think that when a large number of people work in the outer reaches of what you'd expect in a normal course as a prosecutor or as an investigative agent. Like if 1,000 people started investigating 5 grammar schools in Ohio and investigating all the teachers, so, you know, you can rest assured that there'd be a lot of crimes found, right?
Right.
That's not a normal – the way that law enforcement systems should operate. There was some event, things went bad. There's a lot of blame to go around. A lot of politicals that had different levels of influence on the outcome. Police didn't respond perfectly. Some cases they responded in ways that would have created confusion and made people think it was okay to go in restricted areas. There's clearly agents provocateurs creating circumstances where restricted areas were filled up with people. It almost looked like a fairgrounds, and people standing there would have no idea that what they were doing was wrong. They made it easy to just walk into the Capitol in many instances. I mean, people
right.
like to say, oh, I would never fall for that. Let me tell you something. If you're outside and you see a large group of people walking into the Capitol, okay. A lot of people are going to walk in that Capitol, and most people that you talk to had no awareness of what they were doing was wrong. And that's a systemic problem that then take all our resources, hundreds of agents and prosecutors, and focus it on everybody that went through that city and go to Google and get all their Google fencing information on all the phones that happen to go through there and track them. And then go to all the banking information and all the Facebook and the texting, and then develop all these systems for investigating protests, because that's what they're doing. It's essentially an active training exercise for the next one.
Right.
So everything they're learning at this one, they're going to deploy against an Antifa demonstration or against a Mothers Against Drunk Driving demonstration or at the DNC National Convention or at the RNC National Convention or at the public library. You see? So
these are
not capabilities that we want to, and particularly when it has this political tinge. Like,
right.
It should not be the case that I can take 10 defendants and I can say, these people look to me to be MAGA, and I can take 10 people who look to me like they're agents of provocateurs, probably from the other side of the political spectrum, who are doing exponentially worse things, and not only are they not charged, there's no evidence that there's ever an investigation on them, and the government seems to be engaging in an extravagant program that makes it very difficult for any information to come out about those people. Like, that's
okay.
A major problem.
I totally agree. I'm going to have to switch gears real quick. And this is just fascinating. I had no idea how that's working. But can you tell us a little bit, just maybe a little few sentences about this Nuremberg 2.0? Are you into
Yeah, so I'm coming in with that's essentially a projection of how things could unfold. I think it's an overly rosy projection. I think that if we're able to have success, it'll be something in that direction, but it won't achieve all of that. But that being said, if you want to hit the target, you want to aim a little high. So,
and Nuremberg 2.0 is Nuremberg trials from after WW2, prosecuting COVID crimes related.
Yeah. So, it's a real challenge because it's not clear to me where in the United States you could bring such an effort. The federal courts are not going to really entertain it at this juncture, and it'd be hard. Maybe there's a few states where you could get some traction in some local courts, but I think we're still a long way away from that. What we need is consensus building. To that end, I'll direct your attention to Joey's Angels on Facebook. Joey passed away in Hackensack Hospital, Vietnam War vet. He was basically killed by the hospital. And his daughter, Therese, formed Joey's Angels. He's very active on Facebook. Also, a group called If I Had Only Known.
Yes, I remember that.
Managed by Kimberly, whose husband, Michael, was also killed by a hospital. What we're doing now is we have a lot of victims, loved ones who've lost parents, spouses, in some extraordinarily sad cases, children, some survivors.
Right.
We're shining a light on FDA treatment protocols, namely the use of remdesivir, that after 5 days causes organ failure and primes somebody to get on, to be intubated. They get a $5,000 bonus for their remdesivir, and then a 20% bonus on the total hospital bill. And then intubation, I think it's about $30,000 as a kicker. And they get 25 to 37, I believe that's the range we've determined, 25 to 37 medications while they're intubated. And they generally die lingering torturous death. This has happened to hundreds of thousands of Americans.
Crazy.
And so, you know, people say, you know, we can't have the world ever go to a, you know, it can never happen again. Well, you know, I think we're well on our way there.
I agree.
It has happened again, and it's continuing to happen. But the bright spot there is we have these very motivated victims. We just on formerfedsgroup.org, if you click on the organizational tree, you'll see the Humanity Betrayal Memory Project. That page is devoted to recording interviews that we've done with next of kin who've lost loved ones in American hospitals. And also, fascinatingly, people who've actually survived the hospital on COVID, which is fascinating. And you see all kinds of similar things. They're withheld food and water. They're all basically giving them remdesivir whether they want it or not or consent to it. I mean, it's a whole battery of things that hospitals seem to be engaging in, regardless of what state you're in or type of hospital. It's very disturbing. So we're
Brad, I wanted to we only have like a couple minutes left, but wanted you to know that we know a woman that went on remdesivir, was in the hospital for a long time, and she survived. She's fully recovered here in Ohio. So I was surprised when she did that, and I'm happy she is, but I was very surprised. And she's like got a lot of comorbidities as well. So that was a miracle.
Who was this, Kevin? I missed the first part. Who?
It's a friend of ours, of my wife and I's, goes to our church. She survived it.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, there's look, you if you survive, it's despite the best efforts of remdesivir to kill you. I mean, that's
right.
that's my opinion, the opinion of many. It should never have been the drug. I mean, just they need to do criminal investigations on how that became the first line of defense. That's a national scandal of epic proportions. All that has to be investigated.
Absolutely. Well, Brad, thanks for coming on, and we'd like to have you on again in the future. I appreciate what you told us. Anything you want to say before you go?
I just appreciate what you're doing to help us get the truth out. If you weren't devoted to your craft, we'd be in a lot of trouble, because I'm telling you, these are not it's very, very difficult to find a venue or a forum to discuss these deplorables on January 6th, or people have been snuffed out in hospitals from remdesivir. Very few people provide us a forum of being able to discuss it. I very much appreciate it, Kevin.
So, you can follow B. Lee Geyer on Facebook, and he has the remdesivir videos and everything with families, and it's pretty alarming. It's a great service, and I appreciate you doing that. I'm going to have to pass this on to Donna. We'll see what happens. So thanks for being here. And everybody remember, let's see, formerfedsgroup.com. You want to donate to
.org, the formerfedsgroup.org. Both those are websites, but the one that has the Humanity Betrayal Memory Project is formerfedsgroup.org.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank
that
you.
That was you're welcome. That's Brad Geyer, and we will see you guys next week.